Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in Jerusalem, where he's been given a very warm welcome, unlike the reception given to his colleague Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth by European leaders in Munich on Friday, where they sat in stunned silence as he doubled down on President Trump's peace plan for Ukraine, which involves direct negotiations between the US and Russia to the exclusion of Europe and indeed Ukraine. But in Jerusalem, Mr. Rubio got an endorsement of Mr. Trump's widely condemned plan to take control of Gaza and relocate its more than 2 million residents. Then there's a resumption of supplies of heavy weaponry to Israel, suspended by the Biden administration, and Mr. Trump's dire threat of opening the gates of hell for Hamas unless all the hostages are released. Here's the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
President Trump and I are working in full cooperation and coordination between us. We have a common strategy, and we can't always share the details of this strategy with the public, including when the gates of hell will be opened, as they surely will if all our hostages are not released until the last one of them.
Well, Mr. Rubio, on his first Middle East trip, is then expected to travel on to Saudi Arabia for talks with Russian officials, possibly laying the ground for a Trump-Putin summit. The BBC's Tom Bateman is travelling with Marco Rubio and joins us now from Jerusalem. Has anyone in his party, Tom, spoken about what the agenda might be in Saudi Arabia?
No, they're not talking about that at all at the moment. And it's only really because news of this emerged from Washington overnight that we know this meeting is due to take place this week in Saudi Arabia. It will involve Marco Rubio, the National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, along with Mr. Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff. We don't know the makeup of the Russian delegation yet, and we don't know which day it is going to happen, although Mr. Rubio is travelling to Riyadh tomorrow, so it might be logical to expect it could take place as early as tomorrow, although I wonder if it might be perhaps the next day or the middle of the week. But the fundamental point here is this is a startling development. It shows that there has been for the first time in 3 years, a complete reset of US-Russia relations. It follows the call, the direct call, 90 minutes this week between Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin. That was followed then last night by a call involving Mr. Rubio and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Now, there was a very short statement put out by the Americans after that. The Russian Foreign Ministry statement was it contained far greater detail, including suggesting in their claim that the Americans had discussed effectively lifting sanctions, what read like the removal of Russia's isolation, that those issues may have been talked about. Now, all of this, of course, is stunning the Europeans after two extraordinary days at the Munich Security Conference, in which, as you mentioned, Pete Hegseth, the Defence Secretary, basically listed what appeared to be a series of concessions that they expected the Ukrainians to make. Some of that rolled back by him the next day, but certainly we are witnessing, you know, extraordinary developments when it comes to the US position on Russia and the war in Ukraine.
Tom, many thanks. That was the BBC's Tom Bateman speaking from Jerusalem. But the Russian authorities have been rubbing their hands with glee ever since the revelation of that lengthy telephone conversation between Presidents Putin and Trump last week. It wasn't just the contents of the call, territorial concessions to Russia and Ukraine, and Ukraine blocked from joining NATO, but the complimentary way in which Mr. Trump spoke of a man who is, let's not forget, an indicted war criminal. And now this bizarre rapprochement is gaining momentum and could lead to a face-to-face meeting between the two men. Sergei Radchenko is a distinguished professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies who specialises in Russian. He joins us live from Paris. Does Russia have all the cards at the moment? They have the momentum on the battlefield, and now, apparently, in diplomacy as well.
Well, certainly Putin thinks that winds are blown into his sails. He was happy with this conversation that he had had with Trump, and Russians are having high hopes for the forthcoming negotiations in Saudi Arabia. They're not connecting this just to Ukraine, but to broader rapprochement between Russia and the United States, which would allow for Putin to stand tall and proud and say, look, you know, we're back. We're back on among the big and the powerful. The Americans are accepting us as their equals. They want to deal with us. So it's about status. It's about prestige for Putin. And he thinks that it's going well for him so far.
So Mr. Putin is, if you like, being pumped up by the Americans. But do you really believe that what Mr. Trump is proposing will turn out to be the U.S. peace plan for Ukraine?
Well, it is very difficult to see Russia agreeing immediately to ceasefire in Ukraine. This is what President Trump expects. That's what he wants, a ceasefire along the existing line of control. Now, of course, that leaves Ukrainians inside of Russian territory. But suppose Ukrainians were to withdraw from Kursk, that still leaves a situation where the Russians are controlling territory or they're not controlling territory that they have formally annexed. I think that would be Putin's very minimum demand to take over that territory. I'm not sure that Trump would agree to that. And then there's a host of other demands that Putin has about Ukraine staying out of NATO, which I think would be agreeable to Trump. But then also this demand about Ukraine being demilitarized. This is something that was raised in Istanbul back in shortly after Russian invasion, where the Russians and the Ukrainians were having those negotiations. And the Russians wanted 85,000 troops left for Ukraine. Now, that's not nearly enough for Ukraine to defend itself. And I expect Putin to continue to push these kinds of numbers and these kinds of demands. The idea, of course, being that he will be able in a position to control Ukraine or what remains of Ukraine and to leave the country at his mercy.
And what sort of carrots can the United States dangle in front of Mr. Putin? There has been a bleak talk about sanctions.
Well, Putin, of course, expects the lifting of sanctions, and that's a major carrot that Trump still has in his hands. Trump has also talked about Putin's return to the global stage, including to G7 potentially. I don't see this happening, not because just because the Europeans will not accept it, but because for Putin, perhaps it's not so attractive. Trump thinks that he will offer Putin the respect that he thinks Putin deserves, and Putin will take it and agree to a deal in Ukraine. But what he perhaps does not fully understand is that Putin is intent to continue his war in Ukraine because he wants to control the country. And we have seen this from his statements and from his actions. So I'm not sure that we have the ground to compromise here. And I'm not convinced that the Trump administration really has enough sticks and carrots in their arsenal to force Putin to make concessions. Now, Putin may agree to peace talks, but those peace talks may drag out for a long time, even while the Russian offensive continues.
And very, very briefly, it is, of course, the first anniversary of the death of the Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, today. The Russian opposition, such as it is, must be somewhat disheartened about this apparent warming of relations between Washington and Moscow. Very briefly.
Well, the Russian opposition has been scattered effectively. There's very little that remains in Russia at the moment. The economic situation in the country is not particularly well, but, you know, so far we haven't really seen any public protests, and it seems that Putin is fairly secure in his power. Those people who supported Navalny, some, of course, remain in Russia, but many have been exiled and are lamenting his death and marking his death from outside of Russia today.
Mr. Radchenko, many thanks. Sergei Radchenko, Distinguished Professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And let's return now to Jerusalem and try to pick up on some of the themes that have emerged from Marco Rubio's visit to Israel. Let's speak to the BBC's Mark Lowen in Jerusalem. And Mark, Marco Rubio, Benjamin Netanyahu are in lockstep on most issues.
Absolutely. I mean, both men described Donald Trump as the greatest friend in the White House that Israel had ever had. And clearly, this Trump administration is much more pro-Israel than its predecessor, than the Biden administration. Marco Rubio is not even visiting or talking to the Palestinians on this, his first visit to the Middle East in office. That's a very clear sign of the direction that the White House is taking under Donald Trump. They both talked about the need for all remaining hostages to be returned here to Israel. And Benjamin Netanyahu repeated that Mr. Donald Trump's remarks that all hell will break loose if that does not happen. And also both men praised Mr. Trump's recent plan for the United States to take over Gaza and resettle its population abroad, both calling it a bold vision, and Benjamin Netanyahu saying that Israel was working with the United States to turn that vision into reality. But, you know, to be clear, Julian, it would be a violation of international law, any forcible resettlement of the Palestinians, and it's been flatly rejected by the Palestinians and Arab nations, so it's likely to meet pretty short shrift when Marco Rubio goes on from here in Israel to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
And the two administrations, not surprisingly, thinking as one on Iran.
Yeah, both described Iran as the greatest threat to the Middle East and saying that all the terrorist threats in this region originate from Iran and ruling out the any possibility for Iran to ever develop a nuclear weapon. And, you know, again, on this, the White House is going to be much, much firmer on the kind of pro-Israel line. Any kind of attempt to bring Israel back into the nuclear treaty, a nuclear disarmament treaty, is going to be ruled out. So I think a very clear vision, a very clear illustration of where the White House lies on its pro-Israel policy is that overnight, a large shipment of heavy bombs, US-made heavy bombs, arrived here in Israel. They had been blocked for export by Joe Biden several months ago amidst growing criticism of Israel's conduct of its war in Gaza. And now Donald Trump has reversed that block. They've arrived here overnight. That has been welcomed by the Israeli defense minister as a clear reaffirmation of the very strong alliance between Israel and the US.
Mark, many thanks. That was the BBC's Mark Lowen speaking from Jerusalem. And a reminder that you can listen to NewsHour whenever you like. We've got two editions a day. You can find the latest online at bbcworldservice.com. Better still, sign up for our free download. Just search for BBC NewsHour podcast. Do stay with us, though. There's more to come. Coming up, 50 years of Saturday Night Live, we take a look at the show's lasting cultural impact on music with one of its original acts.
Some of it was just so groundbreaking. And SNL had that effect, I think, of showcasing all these iconic musicians. It was not only hilariously funny and had iconic comedy sketches, but also showcased. That was a big treat of the show.
And a reminder of the top stories from the BBC newsroom. Rwandan-backed M23 rebels say they've captured the city of Bukavu in the eastern Congo, adding to fears that the conflict may spread. More on that in about 15 minutes. And the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, on a visit to Jerusalem, has backed Israel's goal of eliminating Hamas. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. It's Britain's biggest night of the year in film, when the stars from the movie world turn out on the red carpet at the BAFTA Film Awards in London. The papal thriller Conclave leads the pack with 12 nominations, closely followed by the gangster musical Emilia Perez. But the build-up to the awards has been overshadowed by the row involving its lead actress, Karia Sofia Gascon, as our culture editor, Katie Razzle, reports.
Medio dentro, medio fuera.
The first openly trans performer ever nominated for Best Actress.
¿Quién soy? No lo sé.
But after Karia Sofia Gascon made headlines for offensive comments she'd previously posted on Twitter, including about Islam and George Floyd, her BAFTA and Oscar campaigns have been derailed.
Are you English?
No, I'm not English. Why?
No, because you... you are pretty.
Netflix has now sidelined her role in its drug lord escaping the mob musical, Emilia Perez, as it pushes to translate its 11 BAFTA nominations and 13 Oscar nominations into awards.
To listen is to accept.
Zoe Saldana is in strong contention for Best Supporting Actress. In BAFTA's Best Actress category, Demi Moore is favourite to win for The Substance.
I thought he said I was good to go.
A zany, macabre thriller about attitudes to ageing. A popular British win would be Marianne Jean-Baptiste's tour de force in Mike Leigh's compassionate comedy drama Hard Truths.
Look at you! Fix your face! You're dealing with the public, handling people's food.
Stop!
She isn't even in the Oscars race.
Oh, you can pipe down and all standing there like an ostrich.
The BAFTAs often reward British talent, which could also benefit Ralph Fiennes in Conclave.
This is a conclave, Aldo. It's not a war.
It is
this a story of the power struggle behind the election of a Pope has the most nominations, 12, and Fiennes is a worthy Best Actor nominee.
If there was only certainty and no doubt, there would be no mystery.
Hugh Grant, the other Brit in that race, would be another fan favourite for religious horror Heretic.
Well, it's so important to find your faith in a doctrine you actually believe.
The front runner for Best Actor is Adrian Brody, playing a Holocaust survivor in The Brutalist.
They do not want us here.
Who do you mean?
The people here. They do not want us here.
The film's so long, there's even an interval. But the post-war architectural drama wowed the critics. Today this could be. The film with the most momentum is Anora, a thrilling, heartbreaking story about a sex worker and the son of a Russian oligarch that won big at other awards in the US last weekend.
I can speak Russian. I just prefer not to, but you can go ahead and speak Russian.
Its star, Mikey Madison, is nominated here for Best Actress and BAFTA Rising Star. With some British money behind it, the Irish-language political comedy Kneecap, about the Belfast rap trio of the same name, is also vying for awards, including Outstanding British Film.
It's like the trauma our ancestors suffered
has inserted itself.
It's actually inserted itself into our genetic code. Popular.
I'll help you. For many, happy. The popular choice to walk away with awards would be Wicked.
Oh, you're green. I am.
Both Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande have acting nominations. But the film may have better luck in the craft categories.
They'll never bring us down.
Katie Razzle reporting. For the moment, the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is largely holding, and with it the exchange of hostages being held in Gaza and Palestinians imprisoned in Israeli jails. There's clearly relief on both sides and some emotional reunions, but also revulsion in Israel and elsewhere at the way in which Hamas has orchestrated the hostage releases for propaganda purposes. The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, has played a central role in the exchanges. Both the hostages and the Palestinian prisoners are transferred from their captors into their care. So what's their assessment of how it's gone so far? Sarah Davis is the ICRC's spokesperson, currently in Jerusalem, who was in Gaza last week.
Not every operation has been ideal, but we continue to publicly call and have discussions directly with the parties and the mediators in order to improve this. We have called for dignity and privacy for both types of release and transfer, for both hostages and detainees. Of course, we know that family members are very, very excited and emotionally overwhelmed for both transfers, that they will be meeting their loved ones again, but they are vulnerable. They are coming out of either captivity as a hostage or places of detention. The International Committee of the Red Cross, we haven't had access to either hostages or detainees, unfortunately, and this is something that we continue to call for. So we don't know what condition they are in.
The television pictures that one sees of the hostage releases certainly has the white vehicles of the Red Cross with the Red Cross on them, just waiting there for the hostages to be delivered. But your role is not that passive, is it? There's a lot more to it.
Absolutely. The fact that we can do these operations, it takes days and weeks and really years of preparation. Our neutrality, the reason that we are the ones able to do this, it underpins a lot of the work that we do. We are trusted by both parties. For these specific releases, there are very intense briefings. There are preparations. We map out different paths. We have logistical and transportation details. We have medical staff and weapons contamination specialists on board. You know, we have colleagues that are in regular contact with the parties to this conflict, as well as the mediators during this. And our neutrality is really a critical component to carrying out this work safely.
So you would dismiss the kind of criticism that has come from some in Israel, that the Red Cross is nothing more than a glorified taxi service in this exchange process.
We understand that emotions are, of course, very, very high. You know, this is a conflict. This is a situation where people's lives have been very much ripped apart. We understand that people are frustrated with what they see, but this is very much a misunderstanding of the role that we play, of the work that we do, and of the that direct discussions that we have with the parties.
Of course, these exchanges of prisoners and hostages are part of a broader ceasefire agreement, and I was wondering how that had to date improved the humanitarian situation in Gaza.
I was in Gaza last week and I spoke to people there. There is a very real sense of relief from people because they are not living through active hostilities. They are not waking up every day worried that they will have their family members killed or that they will be injured. But the humanitarian situation, unfortunately, does still remain catastrophic. People are still living in scraps of material that are their only shelter. It is still very difficult to find enough food to feed your family, to find safe drinking water. It is very, very cold right now. When it rains and when it's very windy, these tents blow away. I've seen children in clothes that they have outgrown, barefoot, walking around in very cold temperatures. The healthcare facilities are still impacted. They have still been physically damaged. They are still struggling to have enough supplies because there has been a deficit of so many things in Gaza for so long.
Sarah Davies from the International Committee of the Red Cross speaking from Jerusalem. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes after a summary of the latest world news. You're with NewsHour. K-pop, or Korean popular music, has taken the world by storm, but it's banned in North Korea. Last year, a young man was reportedly publicly executed in the North for watching and distributing South Korean music and film. So there's a certain irony that a young defector has become the first North Korean member of a South Korean boy band, which will make its debut in the United States later this year. Here's Yoo-hyuk speaking to the BBC.
I tried begging and I tried stealing. When I was about 9, there was nothing left in the house. It was a crisis, like I was going to fall off a cliff. I could have died if I didn't do something. I'm half happy, half anxious now. Where else can I go and have this experience? The world is spinning, it's moving, it's busy, and I feel like I'm part of it.
And Yunaku of the BBC Korean service has been telling me the story of Yoo-hyuk.
Yoo-hyuk is actually one of those 30,000 North Korean defectors right now living in South Korea. In this case, what makes him different is that he has been going through a very hard childhood when he was back in North Korea. His parents divorced when he was 4. And then his father and he lived with his father and grandmother, but both of them were unable to work. So from the early age of 9, he had to make his own living and he had to go out on the street, sometimes begging to find ways to feed himself. He had to sometimes run errands for soldiers or some residents.
So when did he decide to defect?
His mom, after divorcing, she defected to South Korea earlier. And then she sent a Chinese broker to bring her son to South Korea as well. However, Yoo Hyuk wanted to live with his grandmother and his father. So first time he refused to follow the broker and go to South Korea. However, his mom sent broker for the second time. And this time, his father also persuaded Yoo Hyuk to follow the broker. That was when he was 13 that he decided to go to South Korea.
And that new life consisted of the music business in South Korea eventually.
Actually, Yoo Hyuk didn't set out to become a K-pop idol from the start. What really gave him comfort was writing poetry and lyrics because he had been through so much from a young age, unlike many other people. He had this innate fear of sharing his experience and feelings to other people in South Korea because he thought nobody would accept and resonate with his experience.
That was Yoonhee Koo of the BBC Korean Service speaking here on NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. And we go now to the Democratic Republic of Congo, to the mineral-rich east of the country, where a rebel group known as M23 and backed by neighbouring Rwanda have captured two major cities in the space of 2 months. The rebels overran Goma, the capital of North Kivu province, after a lightning advance in January. They've now entered the city of Bukavu, capital of South Kivu province, after meeting minimal resistance from government troops. Videos showed people celebrating as a group of rebels drove along a street in Bukavu. But there's also a dark side to the rebel advance, with reports of looting and lawlessness. A resident of Bukavu, who asked to remain anonymous because of concerns for her own safety, told the BBC that people had been afraid to leave their homes.
The people was abandoned by the National Army because since yesterday the children and the youth took the weapons. They are shooting everywhere in all directions. They are looting. This morning, the M23 entered and they were claimed by the people. They were very happy to see them. We don't know if it's because they are afraid or because they found that there were no authority in the city. It is since 2 days that we are in the houses because the place where I live, the clackling can still be heard in the cities and the streets.
A resident of the eastern Congolese city of Bukavu. And I've been speaking to Manu Lukunze, who writes about the region. He's a lecturer in international relations at the University of Aberdeen. How have the rebels, I asked him, been able to capture so much territory in such a relatively short space of time?
The key thing is these are very well-disciplined insurgent group. They have state backing from the Rwandan government. One of the biggest problems that insurgent groups in Africa normally have is logistics, when they don't have the supplies or their supplies are intermittent. But when you have a state actor that can more or less guarantee your access to the resources that you need, that advances become really easy, and you're slightly disciplined, again, trained by a state actor, you can achieve advances quite quicker. The other side of the story is the incompetence of the Congolese armed forces. They're less prepared, less disciplined. It's a coalition of government forces, but also several armed groups, which have not really proven to be quite the match of the M23.
So the rebels have seized all this territory. What now? What is their end game, do you think?
That's a very important question, because it's easier to take territory. The difficult part is holding the territory that you've taken. And while the M23 has been very successful, it's a relatively small force of roughly maybe 2,500. So yes, you can capture a city because the other forces have run away, but to run a city, you need to police it. And policing a city requires a lot more personnel or soldiers or police, and it requires a lot more resources. It requires administrative capacity, which they don't have. That is still to be proven. So holding the city and holding it in peace and security is a significant challenge that might be beyond M23.
But they've always got Rwanda, have they not, to fall back on?
This is the challenging question. There are three key problems in this conflict: the ethnic connection between the Tutsi and the M23. The second issue is the issue of resources, which we know that these groups and some governments in the region are benefiting from. And the third is the issue of land, of territory. Rwanda is a very small country, one of the most population-dense countries in Africa. So part of the solution will be how and who administers territory and resources and people in eastern Congo.
I mean, the UN Secretary General is warning the situation could push the entire region over the precipice. What does he mean by that?
The Secretary General of the United Nations is very right to point that out. The issues in the Congo have been regional in the sense that since 1997, in the first Congo War, there is a number of states in the region and even outside of the region that have participated in the conflict. Rwanda is a party to the conflict. We know that Uganda has some interest in North Kivu. We know that the South Africans have been supporting the DRC side. We know that the Angolans might come to the aid of the DRC as well. So there's already regional connections to what is happening right now.
That was Manu Lekunze at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. It's an American cultural institution. This weekend, Saturday Night Live is marking its 50th anniversary. The weekly TV show has helped generations of well-known comedians with their big breaks, from Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd to Mike Myers and Tina Fey. But it's not only comedy that the show is famous for. Ahead of Sunday's live three-hour special, the weekend celebrations began on Friday night with a concert featuring musical acts that have featured throughout the years. NewsHour's Krupa Padi has been speaking to Kate Pearson, singer and keyboard player with the B-52s, as she recovered from Friday night's anniversary concert in New York.
It was amazing. It was so thrilling. It was such a blast to get up. We just did one song, and we thought we were going to do Rock Lobster initially, because that's the first song we did. You know, that's the song we did on the first Saturday Night Live appearance. It was in 19... Blah, 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 what was our first
it
appearance?
It was 1980, wasn't it?
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for being my hard drive memory. Rock Lobster was sort of the iconic SNL song that Dave Grohl saw and said, like, it was just so weird. They were so weird. And it just changed my life. And I've heard that so many times that people said, we were so weird. And I was talking to Fred Schneider in our band, and he was like, you know, were we really that weird? We don't feel weird. But apparently it was weird enough to make people sort of jolt and think about music in some different way.
When we talk about Saturday Night Live, we think of it as primarily a comedy show with sketches, with monologues. But what did it mean for music?
To me, I grew up watching, when I was a little kid, the Ed Sullivan Show. And I remember seeing Elvis Presley. And my mother and I and my dad were watching, and Elvis Presley came on, and it was like, whoa, this is so different. And they blacked out his pelvic area because he was moving in a, you know, in a sensuous way. And it was just like mind-blowing kind of thing. And SNL had that effect, I think, of showcasing all these iconic musicians. It was not only hilariously funny and had iconic comedy sketches, but also showcased, that was a big treat of the show, was the musical guest. And some of it was just so groundbreaking, especially Sinead O'Connor. To me, that was one of the most groundbreaking appearances, where she ripped up the picture of the Pope and sang War. It was just a moment, a cultural moment, I think, when somebody made this statement. Nobody in America really understood, I think, what she was doing until later. And everyone was like, really, they're angry. But it was just one of those moments when someone really spoke out.
It almost sounds like these were opportunities to change the conversation, to go rogue a bit.
Yes. I mean, Elvis Costello changed up his song and did Radio Radio, which he was banned from the show for 10 years after doing that. It was just, you know, Billie Eilish, it showcased all these new artists. Radiohead was on, you know, just everyone. The list goes on. Prince, David Bowie. It just, the list continues, you know, Nirvana. So many female artists, too. So many women showcased, which was great, even though rock and roll was such a boys' club.
Here we are marking 50 years of SNL, and it's really put its stamp on American culture. What do you think, Kate, has kept it relevant all these years on?
Well, definitely the political humor. I mean, the continuance of showcasing new musicians, that was always like the amazing kind of treat you would get to see these music performances. But the political commentary, the, of course, imitations, iconic imitations of, I wouldn't even say his name, whoever, the person that's the president, unfortunately, of the United States right now, is, you know, those performances were really gave you this relief, this sense of relief. There was such a tension, maybe political tension or whatever was going on. They would bring this attention to it, but a release of laughter. And that was just like, just so, such a gift to have to watch that show and just laugh.
We do have to mention that you have your own 50th anniversary coming up soon, next autumn, I believe.
Well, this year and this Valentine's Day was our 48th anniversary, because 1977 was the B-52's very first show. It was a house party in Athens, Georgia, Valentine's Day. And talk about weird. We did look weird at that show. We had Cindy and I had these, they were fake fur pocketbooks turned upside down into white afros. We wore black and white, and it was just at a friend's house, and it just we rocked the house. Our friends danced until the speakers fell off the walls, and it was just, that was the day we started.
How are you going to mark it?
Well, we marked it last night.
That's a start.
But the 50th one, I don't know. We have to do something really special. We have been doing Vegas residencies. We have possibly pretty definite, we're going to do some shows with Devo coming up. It's not set yet. I don't want to let the jack out of the box, but it's just so groundbreaking. And it was kind of from the same era when we came up in New York City and going to, you know, playing at the Mud Club and CBGB's and Max's Kansas City. So it was kind of an all home week, too, to see all these other performers. But I don't know how we're going to mark the 50th. We're going to have a big, big something.
That was Kate Pearson, singer and keyboard player with the B-52s. And she was speaking about the 50th anniversary of the US TV show Saturday Night Live to my colleague Krupa Paddy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. European leaders at the Munich Security Conference were blindsided by President Trump's peace plan for the future of Ukraine. They are for the moment excluded from negotiations despite their role in arming Ukraine and imposing a wide range of sanctions against Russia. As one commentator put it, they're not in the driving seat, they're not even in the car. This is the German envoy to Britain, Miguel Berger.
The feeling is that the US has given away too many points, like no NATO membership, no US boots on the ground in Ukraine, things that would have been an essential part of negotiations. So this is the one side, that they have given away too many points before the talks have even started.
So European leaders are trying to clamber back on board with an extraordinary summit in Paris on Monday. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in Munich and joins us now. And Lise, allies often fall out, but the rift between Europe and the United States over Ukraine seems on the face of it irreparable.
Oh, this is not just a falling out. This is a parting of ways. There's a truly a sense here, Julian, at the Munich Security Conference, that this marks a completely new chapter in what they describe here as the transatlantic partnership, the solid alliance between the United States and Europe, that they're on the same side, pulling in the same direction. Everyone I spoke to here, at least the Europeans and the Ukrainians, were saying that this was truly an historic summit, the darkest that they have ever seen. But I have to say it has also galvanized the Europeans, that they've realized that this is their moment now. It's a time of reckoning, that they have to come up with something else to try to meet President Trump, who has his own ideas. And there's no plan, they feel. People talk about a slew of contradictory ideas that they heard from members of President Trump's team here in Munich. So they've got to come up with their own plan. They've got to increase defense spending. They've got to do a lot more. And there was a meeting this morning chaired by the European Union's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas. And as the meeting ended, the Estonian Foreign Minister Margus Tsahkna came out of the interview, and I asked him, I said, well, there's no denying this deep, deep concern among European leaders right now.
Things are more clear. It's better than nothing. And what is clear as well, that Europe must stand up. We need to decide what are the next steps to give Ukraine the opportunity to decide what will happen. I mean that nothing can happen without Ukraine. What Europe can do is actually to give this opportunity, guarantee the fundings and also the military support. That's what we're actually discussing.
And this is about, of course, the ideas about ending the war in Ukraine and making sure any peace deal sticks and that Russia doesn't invade again. But what is at stake for Europe?
At stake for Europe is actually that Putin has not changed the main goal, and he's repeatedly saying that he has these root causes, and the root causes is based on the collapse of the Soviet Union. Even after the President Trump's call, Putin repeatedly says that during these talks he's going to eliminate these root causes, and this is not about Ukraine territory. It's about destroying Ukraine and also pushing NATO back to the situation it was in 1997. So there cannot be anything about Ukraine without Ukraine and anything about Europe without Europe. But Europe is stronger than actually we have been. And I'm not talking only about the European Union. I'm talking about Europe. I'm talking about the UK leadership. I'm talking about Norway and many other countries, as well as Ukraine. So we need to understand what kind of resources we have and decide to use them.
A defining moment for Europe.
It is exactly as it was like in 1938 in Munich. It is exactly like right now.
On the onset of the Second World War.
Yes, we can avoid everything what came then. And I think that the knowledge is here and the understanding and energy. Now we just need to decide. The one thing that Europe has, we have lots of money. And we have Russian frozen assets, 300 billion euros worth. We need to use them right now. And then we have lots of funds to support Ukraine, that Ukraine, if they want to continue fighting for their freedom.
Is the transatlantic partnership finished?
It is not finished. It will remain forever very strong, but it is different because of Donald Trump has different approach. Also, to make this transatlantic bond stronger, we need clarity. And also Trump has asked actually what Europe can do. We must be more united than ever before. And be honest, we have more resources than we are using right now.
That was the Estonian Foreign Minister Tsahkna. And Lise, he sounded relatively upbeat. Will that relative optimism, do you think, be carried over into that emergency meeting in Paris on Monday?
I think they feel buoyed by this sense of solidarity, this sense of purpose. They know now that the moment has come. They heard during President Trump's first administration that they had to increase defense spending in NATO. They had to do much more to take care of their own security. And now President Trump has doubled down on that. He's no longer talking about leaving the NATO military alliance, but he's making it clear that he's actually going to go his own way with his ideas and plans for ending the war in Ukraine. And he's literally leaving the Europeans and the Ukrainians out in the cold. Europe can't accept that. There is too much at stake. Their own security will be affected by any plans for Ukraine. And quite frankly, we heard the Finnish president said that the Americans have sent a questionnaire to European leaders saying, how many troops are you going to contribute to the European force that will have to protect Ukraine after America makes peace through Russia? That is not a deal that Europe can live with.
So there is a suggestion, there are proposals going around for the forming of a European force to be deployed in Ukraine?
Well, Kaja Kallas, the EU foreign policy chief, said they, in response to that proposal by President Zelensky of Ukraine, that they don't need another European army. There is still NATO. They have their own armies. And it is true, Julian, can they really meet the spending targets for NATO? The NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, said they do have to spend more than 2%, which is, and more than 3%, which is around what the maximum they're spending now. Even the Americans are only spending a little bit more than 3% of their national wealth on NATO. This is a time where European economies are under pressure. They've got many, many other priorities at home. It is going to be difficult to find the money to do this, to find the political will. And don't forget that they're also facing challenges from the rise of right-wing parties who, quite frankly, are very happy with President Trump's ideas. Listen to what J.D. Vance, the U.S. vice president, had to say. He didn't talk to the Europeans about foreign policy and working together. He chastised them for their attacks on political freedoms, accused them of censorship, compared them really to authoritarian regimes. So Europe has a lot to sort, and not just with President Trump.
Lise, many thanks. That was our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, speaking from a Munich security conference that is likely to be remembered for some time to come. That's it, though, from this edition of News Hour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.